and together we comprise the American spirit. When one of us refuses to take responsibility, refuses to be accountable, and tells a story of victimhood instead of victory, the American spirit is chipped away. It feeds resentment and despair. And if enough people succumb to victimhood, avoid accountability, and externalize blame, it won't be long before America itself is unrecognizable. 20 years ago, I received a letter in the mail from Rice University. The letter might as well have been addressed, "Dear Failure," because it was indeed a letter informing me that my services were not required at the prestigious school. I had failed to get in. 20 years later, I became the U.S. Congressman who represents Rice University. The path from that failure to present-day success was not an easy one. Many more obstacles and failures would present themselves. Every day, against each small obstacle, I had to tell the right story in order to stay on the path to self-fulfillment. I still do, and believe me, it is harder than ever in my current line of work. But it is a habit that we all must engage in regularly and persistently. Failure, like suffering, has intrinsic value and worth should we choose to confront it properly. Otherwise, the ultimate story of success, whatever that may be for you, will never get told. The stories we tell ourselves ultimately make up our characters and decide our fate. These small stories make up the larger narrative that we build together as Americans. The next chapter is about the American story and what we must tell ourselves if we are going to defeat outrage culture once and for all. Chapter 10, The Story of America. In the flurry of media activity accompanying the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, the New York Times ran a piece that, but for the fact that it was in the New York Times, would have read as parody. "How the Soviets Won the Space Race for Equality," went the July 16, 2019 headline. According to the author, Sophie Pinkham, "The space race was a prime opportunity to signal the USSR's commitment to equality. After putting the first man in space in 1961, the Soviets went on to send the first woman, the first Asian man, and the first black man into orbit, all years before the Americans would follow suit." The moral? Pinkham continues to write, "Under socialism, a person of even the humblest origins could make it all the way up," end quote. Setting aside socialism's tendency, especially in the Soviet Union, to produce rigidly suffocating class stratifications and the occasional genocide, I guess that's a valid point. The reaction to the Times story was swift and informed with historical context, and exposed the misleading angle of Pinkham's essay. As one Twitter user wrote, "USSR and post-Soviet Russia combined? 4 women astronauts since 1963. The USA? Almost 50, including all these firsts: mother, Chinese-born woman, payload specialist, married couple, black woman, Hispanic woman, shuttle pilot and commander, ISS commander, and teacher, also oldest." So why did Pinkham and the Times run this piece? It's possible one or both just really still loved the USSR and wanted to say something positive about it. It's also possible, and more likely, that the piece was an implicit critique of the United States, just another micro-battle in the larger culture war that seeks to tell a different story of America, or perhaps wants a different America entirely. The casualties of outrage culture are many. Careers have been ruined, relationships destroyed, Twitter accounts deleted, and lawsuits filed. Politics has become toxic and vindictive. Therapy visits have increased as depression diagnoses rise. Thoughtful conversations have been substituted by social media snark and insult, where your opponent is assumed to have the worst intentions simply because they are an opponent. Fairness and due process have been supplanted by self-righteous hysteria and public shaming. The meme has replaced good argument. The tweet has replaced the well-reasoned op-ed, and the op-ed has replaced objective journalism. The result is nothing short of information chaos, a culture of contempt, and a deep sense of unhappiness that is blamed on everyone but ourselves. There is another casualty, the story of America itself. The individual stories we tell ourselves, not just about our hardships, but about who we are, combine to create our American story. Every one of us adds a small thread to the larger fabric of our culture. And as we change and evolve, so do our cultural norms. The American story itself evolves. This isn't a bad thing either. It is natural and constant throughout history. But something is changing for the worse. The American story itself is being threatened. Our cultural fabric has often changed and evolved, but it has never been irreparably torn. The closest we ever came was the Civil War. It's worth remembering that one side in that fight set itself against a core contention of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and the other affirmed and extended it. President Abraham Lincoln so believed in the right American story, the one conceived in liberty, that he was willing to fight a war that left well over 500,000 Americans dead, and wounds that would remain unhealed over a century and a half later. I suggest to you that the latest threat to our American story is outrage culture, identity politics, and the victimhood ideology that it elevates. The threat is born of small beginnings, as big threats so often are. It starts with toxic personal narratives wrapped in the cheap cloth of victimhood, always looking to an external culprit to blame for real or perceived injustices. At first, this blame is assigned to an individual, your unfair boss, your neglectful parent, a teacher who refused to see your potential, or just perpetual bad luck. But this isn't enough for the outrage enthusiast. There must be more culprits, more oppressors to be blamed for your misfortune. Those individual culprits become group oppressors, thus expanding the category of oppressors from mere individuals to entire groups of people. The narrative becomes group-on-group oppression as a way to explain any and all misfortune or unhappiness that might occur. These groups may be different, based in skin color, sex, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status, but the story remains consistent. Misfortune or disparity is a result of an oppressive group. Identity politics becomes the new normal, and cultural leaders and politicians take advantage of these stories and even encourage them. Take, for just one example, the New York Times 1619 Project, explicitly designed to reframe the American founding around slavery instead of its actual founding in 1776 and the promise of liberty. Among many other historical inaccuracies, the Times conveniently ignores the fact that America's founding documents were consistently used as the abolitionist movement's primary argument for ending slavery. Grievance reaches back a long way to make its case in the pages of the Times, even blaming modern traffic jams on the legacy of slavery. People are told that they are powerless and oppressed, and there is a specific other group to blame for it. The very real injustices that do exist, some individuals are, of course, victims of circumstance, are conflated haphazardly with perceived group injustices. Your misfortune is not the fault of your own decisions, but a consequence of the 1% who ensure the system is rigged. The phrase, check your privilege, becomes the favorite tactic used to discredit opponents and subvert real discourse. Groups are promised more power over other groups in the form of wealth redistribution, reparations, or wage regulation. The resentment that individuals may have silently felt for one another is encouraged and even elevated as a virtue. Anger is good. Wear your oppression proudly. Resist. Seek revolution. The politics of grievance and resentment become mainstream and arrive in full force. But it doesn't stop there. The identity groups aren't enough. So the natural next step on the oppression hierarchy is our institutions, whether they be government or cultural institutions. The tax system is rigged and unfair, argue the democratic socialists. The very notion of a meritocracy is illusory and unjust, argue an increasing number of journalists and academics. The establishment is rigging the system, scream political activists on the left and the right. The deep state is organizing to overthrow President Trump, conservative talking heads claim. Our legal system shields racists, argues the Center for Human Rights. The fundamental notion of sovereignty and the stronger border enforcement needed to protect it is racist and xenophobic, contend many of my Democratic colleagues. The institution of marriage is oppressive, argue many feminist activists. Ordinary religious groups advocating for traditional values are, quote, hate groups, asserts the Southern Poverty Law Center. The institutions that our society is built upon, law enforcement, religion, the financial system, the government, are labeled as fundamentally oppressive and are shamed and discredited. Other cultural institutions, the media, Hollywood, irresponsibly partake in such labeling and thus become discredited themselves. If not being condemned directly, important institutions such as the Supreme Court come under threat of permanent disfigurement as power-hungry politicians threaten to pack the court by adding additional justices. Even the greatest of our institutions, our constitutional framework, risks ruination as some argue against such vital elements as the Electoral College and the First and Second Amendments. The maniacal desire to tear it all down begins to take hold. Thomas Sowell addresses this problem with characteristic clarity and insight. In his book, A Conflict of Visions, he discusses unconstrained vision and explains, when Rousseau said that man is born free but is everywhere in chains, he expressed the essence of unconstrained vision, in which the fundamental problem is not nature or man, but institutions. Sowell is describing 18th century French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau's absurd belief that only good things can happen naturally, but that all bad things are a result of our oppressive institutions. In other words, your hardships are not natural, not a part of reality, but instead exist only because of oppressive institutions. The blame for suffering is punted to an external and identifiable culprit. It is no wonder, then, that Rousseau was a leading voice in the French Revolution, because only tearing down the institutions, brick by brick, could bring the secular utopia he envisioned. The result was the French Terror, where almost 17,000 death sentences were handed out in the span of a few short years. There's a real and tangible danger in all of this. If our institutions are always to blame, then the next and ultimate oppressor should be obvious: America itself. In the search for oppressors to target, the identity politicians and outrage specialists have found the ultimate boogeyman, our American founding. In a growing number of circles, cheered on by major publications such as the New York Times, America is the vessel and origin of evil, the embodiment of sin against a more enlightened, progressive ideal. This is the heart of the new culture war, which is the fundamental question of whether America is inherently good or inherently bad. The origin of this culture war has many causes. French Enlightenment thinking pioneered the idea that there is moral truth to be found in your feelings and passion, thus removing the need for God. When Rousseau declared that it was the institutions to be blamed for our troubles, he opened up the door for a utopian government that could perfect human nature and the bloody revolutions necessary to implement such a utopia. Marxism, in its crusade against capitalism, was founded on the idea that revolution was a necessary force for good, while the Nazis fully believed in the state's ability to perfect mankind in their vision. The devastating history of the 20th century in Europe was the result. All of these ideologies were built on a foundation that, one, someone else is to blame, whether it be the owners of capital or another race or religion. Number two, that the government existed to perfect human nature. And number three, in light of society's imperfections, the only solution is total revolution. In America, Herbert Marcuse of the 1960s New Left movement championed the idea that only rebellion at all levels, sexual, societal, political, would lead to a respectable version of America. Marcuse advocated not only for rebellion, but also for repressive tolerance as a way to censor speech that was serving the prevailing institutional constructs. He wrote, "The objective of tolerance would call for intolerance. The birth of the notion that speech is violence began with Marcuse, when he called to re-examine the issue of violence and the traditional distinction between violent and nonviolent action. Marcuse argues that the only way to help minority groups and other oppressed people would be to actively suppress their masters, by which he meant the right, and prevailing policies, attitudes, and opinions. As Ben Shapiro writes in his book, The Right Side of History, Marcuse laid the roots of sexual liberation, victim politics, and political correctness. Howard Zinn, a historian and, in his words, something of an anarchist, something of a socialist, maybe a democratic socialist, took to the mainstream the idea that American history was proof of our country's role as an oppressor. In his influential work, A People's History of the United States, Zinn portrays America as rigged by elite rulers who have subjugated their own people and peoples abroad. In a 1998 interview, Zinn admitted that the goal of his book was quiet revolution, where people would begin to take the power back from the corrupted institutions he despised. While one could argue that there is value in presenting counter-narratives to prevailing historical interpretations, the truth is that these counter-narratives have taken an outsized influence in our current understanding of the American story. Even Zinn might have been surprised by this, since he praised the high-minded ideals of the Declaration of Independence as a thing to be proud of. Nowadays, it seems that many young people are being taught only Zinn's version of America and nothing else. The result? A strong and growing desire to tear it all down, including the founding and the ideals it brought forth. All of these thinkers, academics, and historians have contributed to this new, toxic story of America. And these are but a few examples. Navigating this labyrinth of blame and alternative histories that define our cultural struggle is worthy of a book unto itself. But what is at the heart of it all? I believe it originates from the poisonous psychology of victimhood and the search for oppression that it has fostered. In this twisted view, people are categorized into three groups: the oppressed, the oppressor, and the champion of the oppressed. The social justice warriors are, of course, the self-appointed champions, and it is usually conservatives who are labeled as the oppressors, though not always. The oppressed, usually a minority group, are designated by the so-called champions and told that their future prosperity depends on the champion's benevolence. But just targeting specific groups as oppressors has become insufficient for the outraged social justice warrior. It is America itself that must be put on trial and indicted as an oppressor. This malevolent group categorization is at the heart of the war against the American story, and outrage is its primary weapon. I don't think I'm exaggerating my case here. The evidence of this new movement, victimhood ideology turned identity politics, turned into a hatred of America itself, is plentiful and espoused not just by the left-wing extremists, but by elected officials and mainstream celebrities. It's not just the left either. While the right is much more likely to view the story of America as overall positive, there is still that festering discontent with America's institutions and our governing elites that has grown in recent years, and traces of victimhood ideology woven in with it. Distrust of government at all levels permeates the right, often justified but sometimes bordering on conspiracy. As a conservative, I too distrust government institutions because they are inherently flawed, overreach at times, and are often inefficient and poor at solving the problems they claim to be solving. But I do not distrust them because I think they are innately malevolent. And victimhood ideology, defined as the tendency to blame external factors for your situation, is a part of that distrust. Many on the right believe their economic prospects have been diminished because of excessive illegal immigration, for instance. Whether it is true or not, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, with respect to the immigration debate, isn't the actual point. The point is that it contributes to a story of deep dissatisfaction, wherein blame is leveled at American institutions and politicians, and our proud and self-reliant American experiment in representative government becomes a story of being beaten down by someone else. I note with great concern the right's loss of faith in many of our institutions and condemn the burn-it-all-down mentality when I can. But the path from victimhood to American self-loathing is uniquely attributable to the modern radical left. A new example of victimhood as virtue makes the headlines weekly, tied to an indictment of our very own country and sense of self. Wealthy celebrities in particular are all too eager to jump onto the proverbial bandwagon of oppression and lecture us about the evils within our own country. In Vogue magazine, Taylor Swift said, "Rights are being stripped from basically everyone who isn't a straight white cisgender male." Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, elected to Congress at 29 years old, famously said that her generation never saw American prosperity. Such overstatements, totally devoid of evidence, only make sense in the context of a culture that has become accustomed to seeking victimhood over self-empowerment. And because we have elevated the aggrieved victim to such a high status, people are actually creating their own stories of oppression, even if they don't exist. The Jussie Smollett hate crime hoax and many other documented hoaxes are indicative of this desire to be the aggrieved victim. To be oppressed is good for your status, according to the new counterculture. From victimhood to hatred of the traditional American story has proven to be a very short path. The Pledge of Allegiance and the National Anthem are routinely protested. Antifa regularly burns the American flag at its rallies. Last year's 4th of July celebrations were marred by the New York Times video claiming, "America is just okay." The New York Times felt the need, on the 4th of July, to put together a video listing a litany of American failures for no other reason than to push back against patriotism on Independence Day. Activists in Colorado protesting the detention of illegal immigrants at an ICE facility went much further than denouncing immigration policy and actually tore down the facility's American flag and replaced it with a Mexican flag. Nike was forced to cower to the Twitter mob that didn't like their Betsy Ross flag-themed sneakers on the 4th of July, even though the flag simply symbolizes the American Revolution. Meanwhile, corporate interests like major sports leagues and video game companies are perfectly willing to express sensitivity to a totalitarian Chinese Communist Party, all while freedom-seeking protesters in Hong Kong wave the American flag as their symbol against real oppression. The people of Hong Kong seem to understand our American story better than we do. The success of this counter-narrative against America is a result of the left's superior understanding of the culture wars and the need to engage in culture on all battlefronts. The left has conquered academia, pop culture, comedy, and journalism to an exceptional degree. This isn't a controversial statement, just a true one. I will surely be accused of, quote, conservative victimhood here, but the facts are pretty clear. It is not an opinion or a complaint, but an observation. Self-identified liberals outnumber conservatives in journalism by a ratio of 13 to 1. In 2016, 96% of the media's political donations went to Hillary Clinton. Only 9.2% of academic faculty members identify as conservative. The late-night shows are almost exclusively dedicated to ridiculing conservatives. Hollywood actors take great pleasure in using their platforms to express their discontent with the opinions of half the country. And should any of these pop culture icons commit the ultimate sin of engaging in friendly dialogue with the likes of us conservatives, they are viciously ostracized. Look no further than Chris Evans' Twitter comments after he posted a harmless photo of me and him reacting to my Captain America-themed prosthetic eye. He took on even more criticism after daring to launch a website where politicians, including myself, speak with him about certain issues and allow viewers to decide which one they like best. The elements of culture that we should share, music, movies, comedy, education, have been weaponized against political opponents and even the American story itself. We are forgetting how to tell the right American story. We are telling stories of what was done to us and missing the real stories about us. We are letting our hardship be blamed on an other and then quickly indicting the very foundation of our country for any and all grievances. So what is the right story? Is it just blindly assuming that whatever our country does is inherently good and righteous? No, that isn't what I am suggesting. Just because victimhood ideology is toxic does not mean we have never had victims. But we must tell the story of America in a way that squares our suffering and injustice within the American identity without holding it in contempt for that injustice. How might we do that? Let us look to our own history, when the trials and tribulations faced were not microaggressions or offensive tweets, but systemic injustice and persecution. Meet José de la Luz Sáenz, a fellow from South Texas in the early 20th century. He was a schoolteacher, a Mexican-American, in a time and place where that was a hard thing to be. The years from 1910 through 1920 were exceptionally violent along the southern border. The Mexican Revolution exported anarchy across the frontier, including a 1915 insurrection in South Texas that delivered bloody mayhem to those unlucky enough to be caught up in it. The Texas Rangers responded in kind and then some, waging their own bloody and lawless terror campaign against South Texas Mexican Americans. Racial tensions ran high. The year 1917 was nearly the rock bottom of the period. And it was the year José de la Luz Sáenz was called to serve the United States as a soldier in the First World War. Think about what that would look like from the perspective of the modern left. Here's a man from a genuinely oppressed class whose community endures real terrorization from agents of the state, compelled to go abroad and possibly die on behalf of that same state. Sounds like the basis for a protest movement, doesn't it? Perhaps an opportunity for some civil resistance, maybe an opening for a radical denunciation of an America that oppresses its minorities and then sends them to be killed. No doubt an illustration of the fundamental racism and injustice that is the very basis of the United States. You don't have to think very long. It's one of the easiest hypotheticals out there. It would have been very easy for José de la Luz Sáenz to see himself as a victim. It would have been very easy for him to tell that story. Here is what José de la Luz Sáenz actually did. On receiving his induction notice, he put his personal affairs in order, closed up the one-room schoolhouse where he taught in the small town of Cotulla, Texas, and posted a note on the door, including these lines. "You will soon hear that I am holding a rifle in the very trenches of France and upholding our people's pride for the glory and honor of our flag. I am not going on an excursion. I know that the life that awaits me will be difficult, the most demanding that I will have experienced. But I do not think will be as difficult as Washington's crossing of the Delaware and his stay at Valley Forge. If it becomes just as difficult, so much the better. It will be a greater honor for our people. Long live Washington! Long live the Star-Spangled Banner! Long live our raza!" José de la Luz Sáenz, educator, liberal of his day, eventual co-founder of the Venerable League of United Latin American Citizens, did the exact opposite of what the modern left prescribes. Though given a story about something done to him, a story of injustice in peacetime and enforced servitude in wartime, he didn't stop there. He continued the story, making it a story about him and his responses to those things. He knew full well what was happening to his community in those years. He felt in full the sting of official and de facto racial segregation. He understood that coming across a lynch party of Rangers on the wrong country road at the wrong hour would mean his death. He knew that the preceding 8 decades of Anglo domination of his own native Texas had mostly meant a progressive diminishment of his own people's stature and dignity. He knew that the Mexican-American students whom he taught in tiny Cotulla were likely doomed to lower prospects and pay than their Anglo peers, regardless of their talents. José de la Luz Sáenz knew all this, and here's the important thing. He didn't take injustice and use it to reject America. Instead, he demanded that America live up to its promises. He deliberately and willingly inserted and included himself in the great American story. A Mexican-American schoolteacher in South Texas reminded his students that he was walking in the footsteps of George Washington's men. And he was no outlier. In that bloody era, the collective response of the Mexican-American community in South Texas to the lynch campaign of the Texas Rangers was not to reject American identity, nor to rebel in still greater numbers against the United States. It was, again, the opposite of the modern left and progressive prescription. They embraced American identity tightly as the best guarantor of their own rights and dignity. The stories they chose to tell themselves about themselves was an American story. These men could have easily perceived themselves as victims of an oppressor that was embodied by the entirety of America. The injustices against them were real. We cannot escape that fact. Our country's hands are not clean, and we shouldn't pretend they are. But the right story to tell is this. Our country has not always lived up to its ideals, but that does not make the ideals themselves wrong. No one exemplified this better than Frederick Douglass. On July 5, 1852, Frederick Douglass addressed precisely this point in his oration, "What to the Slave is the Fourth of July." 20 times in the address, in referring to the American founding, he invokes the phrase, "your fathers." America and the Americans being a thing, he says, from which he and the slaves of America are excluded. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. Yet at its close, the address takes a turn. Having exposed and excoriated American hypocrisy on Independence Day, and rightfully so, he abruptly situates himself and his story and his hope squarely in the American founding and its documents. Fellow citizens, there is no matter in respect to which the people of the North have allowed themselves to be so ruinously imposed upon as that of the pro-slavery character of the Constitution. In that instrument, I hold, there is neither warrant, license, nor sanction of the hateful thing. But, interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document. I, therefore, leave off where I began, with hope, drawing encouragement from the Declaration of Independence, the great principles it contains, and the genius of American institutions. America was not living up to its own ideals, and Douglass was pointing that out in one of the most eloquent and important speeches in American history. The story Frederick Douglass told himself was a story in which he and every other slave were included in the American story. It was an unbelievably brave and inspirational moment when the gravest injustices did not dim his hope for the American experiment. Imagine if it were different. Imagine if modern outrage culture and victimhood ideology had had their way. What if the story stopped with the things done to them, a cavalcade of injustices and wrongs piled high with no end in sight? Imagine José de la Luz Sáenz defying his induction orders, posting on his schoolhouse door in Cotula an exhortation for his students to join him in La Revolución, bringing more bloodshed to his homeland and communities. Imagine if Frederick Douglass had called for an all-out rebellion not against the pro-slavery Confederacy, but against America itself. These patriots never did anything like this, of course. But we imagine the counterfactual because it illuminates an alternate history exceptionally well. One is the past we didn't have, specifically because the prescriptions of today's anti-American culture were not present and therefore not followed. The other is the future we might have had, were those modern cultural proclivities present. The result would have been a deep and dark dissolution of America. Americans who understand the American spirit build communities of affirmation that embrace and encompass their identities in an American framework. Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr. are in this category. Despite the injustices they faced, the stories they told about America enabled us to better live up to the spirit of equality inherent in the founding and see the good in our American story. Americans who do not understand the American spirit build communities of dissension and discontent, that understand their misfortune as requiring the destruction of America. This is the Howard Zinn, Herbert Marcuse legacy. When you see yourself as a victim of America permanently on the receiving end, then the inevitable outcome is the desire to denounce America in its entirety. Modern politics today swells with this shameless lack of perspective, most prevalently on the left. This phenomenon is even more bewildering when you consider the stark difference in severity of complaints being leveled by the modern left compared to the horrible and very real injustices faced by King and Douglas. House Representative Ilhan Omar, one of my own House colleagues, has expressed her disapproval of the American sacrifice on behalf of her own fellow Somalis in 1993, while also claiming America was founded on genocide. Former presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke took this a step further, proclaiming loudly that America was founded on white supremacy. Founded. Pete Buttigieg, another former presidential candidate, has expressed his belief that Thomas Jefferson was unworthy of public admiration. In early 2019, the city of Arcata, California, removed its statue of President William McKinley, apparently because it implicitly endorsed racism and imperialism. In this mindset, America becomes an untenable prospect. Instead of Lincoln's last best hope of man on earth, or Winthrop's shining city on a hill, our republic becomes a malignance and an object of scorn. How does all of this affect our modern politics? How does outrage culture and the underlying victimhood ideology that permeates it play out in our political present and future? What can we do about it? On the one hand, I think individuals from both sides of the political spectrum engage in outrage culture, albeit in different ways. The hypersensitivity of left-wing students and activists to any perceived offense or injustice is laughable, to put it mildly. The true injustices faced by heroes like King and Douglas would absolutely break our modern-day outrage enthusiasts. Not only do the slightest of disagreements trigger their emotions, but they see value in being the aggrieved victim. The victim hierarchy ideology has actually encouraged people to seek out injustices to be proudly worn as badges of honor. But conservatives are no stalwarts of thoughtful stoicism either. I watch with disappointment as many of my own supporters are drawn in by the angriest and loudest theatrics on cable and the internet, increasingly susceptible to conspiracy, attracted to a form of anarchy hiding in the cloth of conservatism, and willing to deride anyone who doesn't show total compliance and deference to their ideas as Republicans in name only, or rhinos, or establishment sellouts. There are no compelling facts given to substantiate such claims, no coherent arguments made, no room for nuance, just insulting rhetoric and vapid sloganeering. The outrage on the right is different, but it exists nonetheless, and the overall effect is the same. These individual tendencies concern me greatly, enough so that I wrote this book. But what concerns me even more is the question of what we do about it. This is where the left and the right diverge dramatically, and it is ultimately why I believe conservatism is a more responsible and enduring political philosophy. Allow me to explain. There are two major philosophical and existential camps driving our politics today. One of them is, well, mine. I am a conservative. We can define conservatism generally as an approach to governance that values individual freedom, personal responsibility, and moral virtue as a bulwark for that same freedom. We believe in a limited role for government, fiscal discipline, and an understanding that government exists to protect our inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Government does not exist to end your suffering. It exists in order to create the proper structure, based on equality and justice, so that you may pursue your own happiness. It should be noted that this differs from many right-wing libertarians who are aggressively against just about any government role in your life. The other philosophy is that which goes by the label progressive. I want to define this term carefully, since I know many people who identify as progressive and yet agree with me about the proper role of government. The word progressive has assumed many forms and taken on many definitions. When I say progressive, I am not referring to the social norms it may engender. Many young people label themselves as progressive because they support LGBTQ rights, have tattoos, smoke pot, do yoga, and generally live a liberal lifestyle. That is all fine. I can understand all of that. I am not talking about that form of progressivism or liberalism. I am referring to the original ideology of progressivism championed under President Woodrow Wilson. Let's call this political progressivism, as opposed to social progressivism. Wilson's progressivism was, and still is, an aggressively statist philosophy that rejected the Constitution and the checks and balances it protects as outdated and no longer suited for a complex modern society. Wilson and his progressive descendants have long believed in powerful central government that is unconstrained by limiting principles, unburdened by states' rights and individual liberties, able to implement a vision for society that is defined as, well, progressive. I will give my political opponents the benefit of the doubt and say that this is at least mostly well-intentioned, except for the early Wilsonian progressives who targeted journalists, promoted eugenics, and were seething racists. While modern progressives are mostly well-intentioned, I fully reject their ideology as unsustainable, inherently anti-liberty, and naive in its utopian pursuit. I reject this strain of progressivism for yet another reason, which is that it is a false god. It promises something never before seen in thousands of years of recorded human history, the end of suffering. But wait, you might ask, what is wrong with trying to end suffering? This seems like a noble and virtuous goal. It is in our nature to relieve our friends and neighbors and, in the Christian sense, our enemies of pain and agony and burden. To do so is not only just, but a higher calling. After all, isn't the point of progress to improve the human condition? Of course it is. But it is one thing to strive for human progress and quite another to believe that an all-powerful government can enforce that progress or even define what it looks like. This is where progressivism begins to blur the lines of political philosophy and a faith-based belief system. For it relies on the false premise that an all-powerful government can deliver upon the ultimate eradication of suffering. In this sense, it imitates Christianity, with a promise to wash away the sins of the world. But there is a very deep and fundamental problem with this. While the sins and expectations of the Bible are well-defined, based in thousands of years of wisdom, human experiment, and transcendent truth, the sins that the progressive wishes to eradicate are decidedly not. They are ever-changing, as is the case with any man-made moral structure. It is flawed because, for the progressive, morality can be relative. And when morality is relative, it can be changed according to popular opinion or social whims. The targets, or the sins to be eradicated, become increasingly bizarre, ranging from the boycott of Chick-fil-A to enforcing the ability of biological men to compete in women's sports. The goals of the progressive, whether to end suffering or reform human nature into an imagined utopia, are based on the mortal preferences of a select few, not the universal and transcendent authority of an all-knowing God. Outside of the spiritual false promises of progressivism, there is also a very practical dishonesty at play. Certain questions quickly arise. Who defines progress? What is considered good in this brave new world? What if we disagree? There are obviously certain issues that people of all political stripes agree should be addressed by government: security, protection of property rights, and regulation of interstate and international commerce, to name a few. We often agree on certain social safety nets and anti-poverty initiatives as well, though conservatives and progressives tend to disagree sharply on how to implement such efforts. But the modern progressive is far more likely to believe that these basic roles can be expanded indefinitely, so long as enough enlightened policy wonks with sufficiently elite PhDs are there to craft the ultimate solutions for all to live under. While it may be true that unique expertise is required for, say, nuclear power regulation, it is far from obvious that the same can be said of most social or economic policies. This sort of social engineering fails the test of practicality for two basic reasons: knowledge and preference. It is utterly impossible for elite policymakers to have the knowledge necessary to craft such bold proposals, and it is utterly conceited to believe that all Americans have the preferences that those same elites want them to have. Modern political progressivism has shifted from addressing basic needs to all needs. The New Deal of the 1930s is a far cry from the current promises of Medicare for all, free college, free housing, and a job guarantee, to name but a few. This progression is predictable. After all, the ideology of well-intentioned progressivism is based upon promising more government services to constituents. Eventually, you run out of basic promises and must come up with newer and bolder promises. As these promises become more extreme, the modern progressive must create societal afflictions to justify such bold action. And it seems that the more just our society becomes, the louder the progressives scream injustice. This isn't surprising when, in fact, their entire governing philosophy is predicated on fighting injustice. You're out of a job if the problem begins to disappear. So they make sure it doesn't. They must make their ideas seem superior to the status quo, to the current system of American government. And since you cannot elevate progressivism above its self-described divine intent, you must bring America down in order to justify change. Look at what progressivism contends against: systemic forces, real and imagined, that bear sole responsibility for the ills and evils afflicting mankind. Capitalism, racism, sexism, everywhere an ism. The tenets of victimhood ideology become the force by which modern progressives make their case to voters to gain more power. "Give us power," say the progressives, "and we will end human suffering. We will end failure. But until we do, stay angry. Stay outraged." It's an approach that does more than diminish the country. Far worse, it diminishes people. That's why you'll never see a happy or funny social justice warrior. A system that falsely promises the end of suffering also strips individuals of the capacity to deal with it. It's ontological malpractice, and it's growing. I should also note that I don't believe it is only progressives who have fallen into the trap of endless false promises. We do see it on the populist right as well, where voters are told, "If you elect me, I will make you happier." Voters are promised better jobs, better everything. That being said, in practice, the Republicans using this kind of language still implement a far more measured and limited policy approach, thus neutering the danger of excessive government overreach. However, the effect on the psyche of the population is unfortunately the same, because the message is this: someone else can solve your problems. Someone else can end your suffering. This is a deeply dishonest trick played on the American public, where politicians boldly produce impossible promises for the sake of votes. When Elizabeth Warren was criticized during the 2020 Democratic primaries for her Medicare for All plan being unrealistic and unaffordable, she responded by asking what the point was of running if she wasn't going to promise bold reforms. Ironically, we always hear that elections are bought, or votes are bought, and politicians are bought. The truth is much simpler than that. Votes are bought, yes, but not by some murky corporatist overlord. They are bought with the currency of politicians' false promises. Adherence to this ideology allows and encourages people to tell the wrong story. Instead of a belief in self-reliance, dependence on government promises becomes normalized in the collective narrative. This replacement of personal responsibility with dependency has the fundamental effect of disempowering people. As I've said, if you aren't personally responsible, you are disempowered. It is completely and utterly self-defeating, and it creates the kind of resentment and despair that leads to widespread outrage culture. It is up to us, all of us, to reverse this trend. As a culture, we have to decide collectively that we will no longer be bought off by false promises. We must decide that our happiness is ours to pursue, not given to us by a supposedly benevolent politician. We will decide that our story, despite all the suffering we may endure, is not the product of an external, immovable force, but our own to contend with. We must decide that we will be empowered and in charge of our own destiny. We must decide to tell the story of America that embodies the founding ideals and gave us the miracle of opportunity that we have today. We must tell a story that we are proud of. This is the path to mending our cultural fabric. We began to tell the story of America that we should be telling. We should start by recognizing that America is a miracle, a product of the best and most promising ideals that humankind ever had. The founding was the ultimate political and cultural experiment, where the great minds of Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Washington, and others could craft the blueprint for a new country using all the lessons from thousands of years of political and philosophical evolution. These ideas, the greatest lessons from the cities of Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, and London, were studied and drawn upon by our founding fathers to craft the Declaration of Independence and Constitution. In The Roots of American Order, Russell Kirk wrote, "Whatever the failings of America, the American order has been a conspicuous success in the perspective of human history. Under God, a large measure of justice has been achieved. The state is strong and energetic. Personal freedom is protected by laws and customs, and a sense of community endures. America has been a purveyor of freedom and prosperity throughout its short existence. We can tell the story of our sins, and we should, for greater perspective. But we must also recognize that these sins do not render corrupt the foundational ideals of America. Our imperfections do not define us. What does define us is the greatness that America has generated. Since the rise of America as a world power, human prosperity has undeniably flourished. It was America that led to the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. It was America that rebuilt a war-torn Europe and Asia. It is America that has underwritten global security for free trade and commerce. It is America that has led the world in innovation, from energy to advanced computing to the internet, and shared that technology with the world. It is American innovation that put a man on the moon, pioneered manned flight, and led to healthcare breakthroughs like the first organ transplant, the MRI, and the human genome map. It was America's unwavering defense of freedom and human rights that prevented the scourge of communism from becoming a global power. This is our story. Like many stories, it is filled with villains, heroes, dark times, proud victories, sadness, overwhelming joy, failures, and triumphs. It is a human story, after all. It carries with it all the inescapable imperfections of the human condition. But just as your story does not end with your sufferings or your failings, neither does ours. America is a fabric woven from the threads of human history's most noble achievements and greatest ideas. The American system of government, the first to enshrine natural rights, liberty, and equality, is a pinnacle of human enlightenment born from thousands of years of civic experimentation and ancient wisdom. The American spirit is a product of the oldest and most important virtues: self-sacrifice, courage, tolerance, love of country, grace, and passion for human achievement. These foundations have underwritten our great American story, and it's a story with a consistent and enduring creed: fortitude. Fortitude remains the common thread in our American story. I wrote this book because I fear we are in danger of losing it. And what might be left if we do? Fragility and cultural decay, a slow demise of a nation that no longer believes in its own greatness, and an unwillingness to be the beacon of freedom and moral truth that we have long embodied. This is an unacceptable future, and we should avoid it at all costs. The good news is that we can. We can decide right now that American greatness will not be rejected nor squandered. As the American founding was grounded in individual liberty, so will be our future. Our rediscovery of our own strength must be an endeavor undertaken by each and every one of us. Mahatma Gandhi said, "Man often becomes what he believes himself to be." We believe ourselves to be capable of strength and courage and a purposeful existence, and so it will be. Our heroes guide us. I told you before about the SEAL ethos. Perhaps we now need an American ethos. Perhaps it goes something like this. I will not quit in the face of danger or pain or self-doubt. I will not justify the easier path before me. I decide that all my actions, not just some, matter. Every small task is a contribution toward a higher purpose. Every day is undertaken with a sense of duty to be better than I was yesterday, even in the smallest of ways. I seek out hardship. I do not run from pain, but embrace it, because I derive strength from my suffering. I confront the inevitable trials of life with a smile. I plan to keep my head, to be still, when chaos overwhelms me. I will tell the story of my failures and hardships as a victor, not a victim. I will be grateful. Millions who have gone before me have suffered too much, fought too hard, and been blessed with far too little for me to squander this life. So I won't. My purpose will be to uphold and protect the spirit of our great republic, knowing that the values we hold dear can be preserved only by a strong people. I will do my part. I will live with fortitude. Acknowledgements. Writing this book was the first time I thought deeply about the lessons I'd derived from the SEAL teams and life in general. It is quite the challenge to examine your own attributes, your failings, and then attempt to extract the lessons from your past that make you who you are today. This book is largely a product of that journey. But like every book, it is also a product of many hands. The idea for this book came out of a breakfast meeting with my agent, Keith Urban, when we met for the first time in late 2018. I want to thank Keith for his guidance throughout the process, helping me craft the first outline and subsequent drafts, and ensuring I was in good hands with some great writers, editors, and publishers. I want to thank my editor, Sean Desmond, for his guidance throughout, and for helping me craft something I can be proud of. I want to thank Josh Trevino for the long hours we spent talking over the concepts in each chapter, helping to organize my thoughts and experiences into coherent lessons that would make lessons from the SEAL teams relatable to a wider audience. I'm also very grateful for Josh's encyclopedic knowledge of Texas and American history, which made the research aspect of this book far less time-consuming than it otherwise would have been. Thank you, Carrie Rom, who worked long nights to see problems in the first draft that no one else noticed. Is a better product because of you. Thank you, Hannah Anderson, for helping me with the necessary policy research. Thank you, Dr. Scott Allison, who sent me vital social science research on heroes and suffering to check my own intuition. Thank you, Carl and Gigi and the crew. I never would have completed the first draft on time without you. If anyone deserves credit for this book, it is John Noonan. Back in 2017, John suggested I run for Congress. I did. 2018, John suggested I write a book and proposed I take a meeting with Keith. I did. I also want to thank John for taking a highly critical approach to editing. His input helped me create a much better final product. My dad also took it upon himself to spend countless hours reading through the book to give me the feedback I needed. My dad is responsible for giving me the most consequential idea of my entire life, the idea to become a SEAL. Thank you, Dad, for researching our Texas family history and for staying strong for my brother and me after my mother's death. Thank you, Carmen and Lewis, for being loving members of our family. Thank you, CJ, for always being a loyal brother. Thank you to my entire amazing family who shaped who I am today. Crenshaws, the Breckwalds, the Smiths, the Bartleys, and the Thompsons. I also want to acknowledge the Americans whose stories and deeds informed my understanding of fortitude and our national spirit. We live by reason, but we learn by examples, and I've been blessed with some very good examples indeed. I want to thank every warrior I ever served with. The SEAL teams gave me more than I can ever repay. My 10 years with the teams was an experience I would not trade for anything. I hope this book makes you proud. Long live the Brotherhood. Thank you, Nan and Terry, for always being there to support me and Tara. You've always shown us what true generosity and love look like. Some of the most important edits came from my wife, Tara, who knows me best. She is my rock and is responsible for the confidence I have today. Just a minute ago, she told me how good-looking I was. It was strange and out of place, but she did it anyway. She's obsessed with me. She stuck with me through the worst of times, and she understands the lessons of fortitude better than anyone. She's also the first to tell me when I don't live up to those lessons. Thank you, Mom, for being the first to show me a true hero. You are the embodiment of fortitude, and my brother and I have spent our lives trying to live up to your memory. This book is for you. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Fortitude, written and read by me, Dan Crenshaw. Produced by Robert Van Kolken. Directed by Allison Elliott Yarden. Fortitude is also available in print and digital formats from 12, an imprint of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by Dan Crenshaw. Audio production copyright 2020 by Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.